Welcome to episode number 263 of Six Pixels of Separation, the Twist Image Podcast. My name is Mitch Joel, and it's Sunday, July 24th, 2011. I'm really excited about this conversation. Enjoy the show. So who are you and what do you do?
Oh, just like that, huh?
It's just like, that's how we roll, man.
All right. Who am I? My name is Derek Sivers. What do? I talk to Mitch.
You code. I mean, so Derek, you're the founder of you created CD Baby. You've created a viral sensation with your video about how to create a viral sensation for TED.
Nice. How meta.
Exactly. And you just wrote a great book called...
Anything You Want.
Anything You Want. So let's start off with the book. What was the spirit of writing the book? Like, what was it that got you excited about doing it? Because I know you've been offered probably over the years, a ton of people have come to you and said, tell the story of CD Baby and how you built this.
Yeah, I never planned to. Honestly, I kind of prefer blogging. I think it's, I like this, the immediate feedback of just putting something out there for free, one article at a time. And so for years, people have been asking me to do a book, and I just said, no, not interested, no way, just read my blog. That's I'm cool with that. And then Seth Godin asks me to write a book. And more than that, he called me, you know, last year and said, I'm starting a new publishing company. I want you to be one of my first authors. And I said, okay. So, you know, and just like that, my plan completely changed. So I'm like, all right, I can do a book. So, you know, we went back and forth a few times. At first, we thought maybe I would write something that was more like a handbook for musicians. And I gave an attempt at that for a month or two, and it wasn't going too well. And he said, well, how about we just tell the story of CD Baby? I said, all right, I could do that. So honestly, man, it was, I feel almost like I cheated because it was effortless. I know so many of my friends have spent like, you know, a year or two writing a book and say it's harder than they ever imagined. To me, it was like 2 weeks. And I just put the whole thing together, and it was kind of telling the stories that I've been telling at conferences and stuff like that for the last few years anyway. So I had all of these stories on the tip of my tongue. It was just a matter of putting them all down in one place.
Was also part of it, I mean, you know, the sort of, I guess, the backstory to you and I becoming friends is we met through Seth Godin at TED.
Yeah.
So like there's all these weird connections. But is the backstory of it too, just when you know, the way Seth positioned the Domino Project, it's like, it's not like you get this big chunky contract from a publisher with all this serious legal stuff that says you have to deliver 80,000 words, and it's like 80,000. Was part of the facility of it the fact that Seth makes it really sort of like it should only be as long as you think it should be type of thing?
Yeah, I think in that first call, I mean, I should ask him someday if I'm allowed to share the contract that he sent me, because it is stunningly beautiful. It is like the most jaw-droppingly beautiful contract I've ever seen. It is literally one page, and it's written in plain English, so much so that I didn't realize that was the real contract. Right. And he said, and I said, so when are you going to send me the contract? He said, well, no, that thing I sent you a couple weeks ago, that was it. I said, that was the contract. Oh my God. So yeah, it really was like, he said, look, we're thinking about 15,000 words. They're short little books meant to be read in under 90 minutes. Just make it like a conversation, make it personal. There's no advance, but we split the profits and go for it. And that was about it. You know, no formalities. It was really just, in fact, I began just on that phone call, and then I didn't really, you know, I didn't need to wait for the formalities. I trusted him. So
was part of your real spirit in doing this the fact that when you look at what a book is, it can be sort of this daunting thing if you're into blogging and music and all that, but it sounds to me like I'm getting a vibe from you that it almost felt like a good creative expression for your creativity that maybe you weren't sure you wanted to do. Is that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, to be fair, I mean, Seth really drove the whole thing. So, I mean, if Seth would have called me up and said, I want you to write a 2,000-page giant book, I still would have said, okay. You know, I mean, he's just such a role model for me that when whatever he said, I would have just trusted his judgment and done it. So, so this was still kind of his vision, this idea of these short little books. So that's the kind of the Domino Project, or all these little books. And I think he's having a great success with that. And it's really funny to read the reviews and so many people saying things like, you know, I don't ordinarily sit down to read a book, but it only took me an hour, you know. And people seem to like that. Maybe you and I are kind of more used to reading books that take 12 hours or something, but a lot of people aren't. So, but let's see. As far as like a creative expression, to me it was more like the end of a little era for me. I feel like in my 10 years of doing CD Baby, I did some stuff right and I did a lot of stuff wrong. And I'm kind of intentionally rubbing my nose in the mistakes, you know, to use the old kind of like dog metaphor, that I really want to make sure that I really learn from my mistakes. So I'm sharing them publicly, which, you know, might even seem almost a little embarrassing. I mean, I'm sitting here just loudly telling everybody all the stuff I did wrong. But I feel that I needed to do that to kind of make sure that I was learning from my mistakes and perhaps be a warning to others, saying, you know, hope you don't have this same situation. But I think I just needed to just be done with it. You know, it's like at this point, it's been 3 years now since I sold the company and I'm ready to move on. But I had to just kind of do this one last thing of, okay, let me just once and for all share everything I learned in 10 years of doing this, so that I can just shut up and not tell these stories anymore and move on.
Right. I want to talk a little bit about CD Baby in the sense of, you talk in the book about how you never really had a vision statement or a vision for the company when people asked you. But in thinking about it, the vision actually was a big idea. The vision was that there are a lot of independent artists that want to sell their music online and they're struggling with it, and I can help facilitate that, and that's what I'm going to do. And it seems so, like, to even say that now in 2011, it sounds like it's so stupid. Like, you know, right? But we fail to realize that it really was a radical thing, because one, just the transmission of audio technically wasn't all that obvious back then. Two, you weren't even talking about digital transfers originally. It was literally mailing CDs. I mean, this was a very different world. And what I'd love to do is go back and what was that moment when you realized somebody should do this? And why isn't someone doing this? Because I think that that's the sort of moment marketers and business people are constantly trying to understand, like, where people come up with it.
It was really just self, you know, sorry, it's just the old scratching your own itch thing that, like, I wanted to sell my music online. There was no place that would sell it for me. So honestly, I was like, ah, fuck it. How hard can it be to just go get a stupid credit card merchant account and just do it myself? So it was really not like, it wasn't this feeling of, ooh, this is a huge business opportunity. It was really just like, I was just doing it for me. Like, I just needed to get my stuff up and selling online. I thought it was stupid that the big online record stores wouldn't take my account because I wasn't distributed by a major label. So I was like, all right, well, then I'll just build one myself then. So it's kind of more like this hacker culture that a lot of kind of Linux programmers and people that do programming for the love of it are often tossing these things together all the time. You know, like, hey, I want something that will tap into the GPS system of the Singapore buses and tell me how many minutes until my bus arrives. Why doesn't that exist? Ah, damn it, you know, I'll make it myself. So hackers are always just throwing these little things together, right? So to me, it was like setting up my own credit card merchant account, setting up my own little store, was just a little hack because nobody would do it for me. Then it was like my friends just asked me, hey man, can you sell my CD through that thing? And I honestly hadn't even considered it. So I really wasn't looking at it as a business. So it wasn't until my friends asked and I went, oh yeah, I guess I could. Sure. All right. I'll hook you up as a favor. Don't worry about it. You know? So then I started getting calls from strangers like, hey man, my friend Dave said you could sell my CD. And I'm like, okay, if you're a friend of Dave's, no problem. I'll hook you up. And so I just was hooking up friends as a favor. I still didn't think of it as a business. You know, my business was making music. I was living my dream. I was a professional musician, kind of like making my living by doing gigs and producing records. It's like I was living my dream come true. I did not want something to get in between me and my music. I didn't want to start a business, but oh well, it happened anyway.
Now, the trajectory of it in terms of its growth, it's well documented, but I'm wondering, when you're in the middle of it, one, can you feel it? And two, it seems to me in the book, and this is something that I'm living, you know, you and I've talked about this offline actually, where, you know, I've got a bigger enterprise with two offices, and you struggle with this sort of balance of you're doing the work that you love to do and you just want to be in the middle of it and love it. But then there's the other side where, like, these business viruses infect you with, like, oh, I need X amount of growth, or I have to sell, or I have to do this. And in the book, I thought you did a better job of, and I read a ton of books, than anyone else in really illustrating the struggle that you had, and to the point where it even upset you with some of it, even upset the apple cart at work in terms of the employees, and, you know, this Derek is being very belligerent to, like, the growth of business.
Yeah.
Like, can you talk a little bit about that struggle? Because I don't know that many business people and even marketers really talk about that, and especially the way you did so candidly.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that. The thing, okay, and this may sound weird of me to say this, but I'm a really happy person. And I don't know if it's just genetic or something. I've always just been a happy person. Like, my natural disposition is happy. And so, but then I was even happier than ever the fact that I was making a full-time living with my music, right? It's like I was living my dream come true. And then CD Baby started to take off. And I was even happier because I was really kind of enjoying learning how to make a website and how to make a little system that was satisfying so many people. And then the money started to pour in. I was really, really happy. So the reason I'm mentioning this is because I think a lot of this, like, really driven business growth where people are just like, no, we have to push, we have to build our numbers, we have to this, we have to, you know, I need to buy a mansion, I want to buy a Ferrari, I want to double our sales this year. A lot of it's really driven from dissatisfaction. It's driven from somebody not being happy and needing to push and push and push to be happy. But I was just already happy. So it's like I didn't want the business to be bigger. I actively did not want it to grow because it just, to me, felt a little bit like, you know, more money, more problems. Like, I don't need the trouble. Like, I'm cool. Like, I don't need more money. I don't need more customers. I'm cool. So I was actively trying to slow the growth of the company. And so now, with that being the context, imagine that some venture capital dude, and imagine that it's like, I've got enough money in the bank so that, like, I could have pulled the plug at any moment and not had to work for at least a few years, right? So now imagine that some VC investor dude from Silicon Valley calls up with his slick kind of salesman voice. And he's like, hey, you know, we'd like to, you know, invest in your company. You know, we could build this thing. You know, if you get the right kind of growth in this thing. I was like, no. Like, I don't want to talk to you. Let's not even talk any numbers. I'm just not interested. Let's just say goodbye right now. I don't want to talk to you. Bye. And they were so surprised at that. But it's like, I was just happy. I didn't want some, you know, millions of dollar in venture capital and all of a sudden having investors kind of breathing down my neck telling me to grow the business fast so they can get their investment back. I just didn't want that, you know? So does that help explain a bit?
It does. And it's funny. I guess the context of me thinking about it is when I was thinking about the newspaper industry and people, you know, are obviously spelling its demise and stuff. And I looked at it and said, you know, it's really hard. Like, I had always wished the newspaper publisher would get up on stage in front of the shareholders and say, listen, it is what it is. Before the internet, people were reading less and less. The world's changing. But if we actually want to innovate and be a real publisher in 2011, it probably looks nothing like our business. And if we want to move towards that, we're going to have to stop trying to hoard all these crazy profits and make more money and more money, because we really need to invest in what the future of publishing looks like. And I say that laughing and half smirking, but the truth is I don't know that they could do anything else. But the truth is, what publisher would do that? What publisher would get up and say, and the model is so crazy, like the business model we have, and I think you're so spot on. It's really about how much more money did you make? What was your growth over last year? And I don't understand how it'd be like, you know, I always use the analogy, like, Derek, next year I want you to be better looking. I want you to be thinner. I want you to be more fit. At what point do you get to the point where you're like, listen, I just got to maintain here. You know, like, I can't.
Yeah.
I'm happy. I'm comfortable. And I think that we have, it's almost like a disease in business. And again, as a marketer, we feel it every day, right? It's like, I want you to do this ad, but it has to be able to increase sales. Those aren't always things that correlate so naturally. So I think part of the struggle that I heard you say, and you asked me, does it make sense? It makes sense, but I wonder if that's a cultural thing for people who are the same age as us, just the way we were brought up. It's like, it's not all about money. Or if this is the changing of a world, and I'd like to hope it is, but I get nervous.
No, okay. I think it's neither. I've learned a lot living in Asia. So for those of you listening, I moved to Singapore about 8 months ago. So I live full time in Singapore now.
I know it sounds like we're just sitting across from each other, but you're in Singapore.
I know. Thank you, Skype.
Exactly.
So. There's a different mentality over here. In fact, you know, I just got back from a week in Japan, and there's a very different mentality in Japan than there is in China. Vastly different, huge difference. So Japan has this sense of comfort. Japan has been quite wealthy for many generations, so people are not desperate. So if there's a wallet on the sidewalk, somebody will pick it up and return it with all the money inside to the nearest police station and not even think for one second about taking the money inside. That's just culturally, you just don't do that. Part of it is just there's not that sense of desperation. Everybody's doing fine. But China, on the other hand, is ruthless and cutthroat. And, you know, it's all about how many generations away from poverty are you? And right now, China is zero generations away from poverty. They are just getting out of poverty just in our lifetime right now. So there's this desperation, you imagine the kind of Oliver Twist kind of you see a piece of bread, you get it. It's like this kind of this desperation of get what you can while you can now. We've been broke for generations and now we're finally getting our piece. Just ruthlessly get everything you can. So now I'm talking about countries, right? But now that happens on an individual level too. Some people just as individuals have this thing where it's whether it's because they're just one or two generations out of poverty or something, they have this intense drive. They need to prove themselves fast. They're not happy yet. They need to kind of and who knows? Maybe it's also because they're really susceptible to advertising and they've read too many biographies of Richard Branson or something, or they read Inc. magazine and they think that they're not successful until they've made $1 billion, That whole punchline from the Social Network movie, right?
$1 million isn't cool. $1 billion is cool.
Yeah. It's like, oh, shut up. $1 million is very cool. So sometimes I think it comes from that that extreme dissatisfaction, which come from desperation. But if you're just feeling happy and satisfied, and if you realize, which sometimes it takes a few generations to realize that, no, past a decent, comfortable, upper middle class level, more money doesn't make you happier. Once you have $1 million, then $2 million doesn't make you that much happier. So at a certain point, you need to just realize this and kind of stop pushing. And I think that's where some really interesting stuff happens. You look at what some people have done after they've become successful. It's a really telling moment where it's what did U2 do since 1983? Lots of stuff. They could have just stopped there, but they kind of hit this point where they musically have been very inventive and done lots of things. Or whether you want to pick a David Bowie or a Paul Simon or whoever your kind of musical heroes may be, it's really interesting to see what some people do after they get to that point of comfort. And now they kind of have this freedom to explore and not need to be desperate for sales and whatnot. So no, I don't think it's I don't know if it's a thing of our times. I think it's definitely a per person kind of thing or a per culture kind of thing.
Yeah, there would be a cynical person or two who would hear you speak and say, easy for Derek to say, sold this company for $20 million plus, right? It's easy. But I like the way you preface this by saying that you were happy just by being in the music industry, by doing what you sort of wanted to do.
Exactly, and that's that was, it's really important to understand that for the context, because somebody else read my book and sent me an email saying, you know, I get the feeling like you were rich to begin with. Like some of the stuff saying, like, I can't relate to it. You know, my parents grew up on a farm. It's up to me to support my three kids. I need to make lots of money. I can't just, hey man, be cool like you, whatever. But yeah, that's why I'd really have to emphasize. It's like to understand the context of why I was so kind of like chill about my business and not trying to squeeze every last dollar out of it is because I was just happy. And honestly, I learned when I was like 18 how to live really cheap. I mean, honestly, man, it's still people are shocked. I mean, okay, so like I'm a multimillionaire now or whatever, but you know, my place here in Singapore, I mean, I furnished the whole place in 3 hours at IKEA in $2,000, you know, and that's it. It's just like a little two-bedroom apartment. I don't own a car. I don't own a house. I'm just renting a two-bedroom place. And it's like, but it just, that makes me really happy that the less I own, the happier I am. So I was never filled with a big desire to have expensive things anyway. So I was living really, I mean, still to this day, I only have one pair of pants and one pair of shoes. You know, I'm not kidding either. I'm not trying to like.
But you do wash them.
Yeah, about once a week. Yeah, it's good enough. But so, you know what I mean? It's like, so we all set our base level. Some, and it's kind of sad to me. We all know these types that, who knows, maybe even people listening to this are going to get offended when I say this. But it's funny when people tell me that they need, like, oh, well, I need to bring in like $200,000 a year. Otherwise, you know, that's just my living expenses. I think $200,000 a year to live? Like, what the fuck? Like, what kind of like 9-bedroom house with 4 cars? Like, stop it. You know, like that's what's kind of sad is like some people say, oh, I'd love to start my own business, but I can't because I need to make my baseline of $150,000 a year just to pay my living expenses. And it's just like, I think, God, my. Sorry, I'm kind of rambling on this, but it's a real key point to me. When I was my first like major girlfriend in life, like the one I was with for like 6 years from the age of like 18 to 24 or something, her parents were classic New England hippies, like really like living on a commune in Vermont. And she grew up with no electricity and no TV and just really, you know, eating only food from the garden. And both of her parents only did occasional little odd jobs here and there. Her mom was like a seamstress and her dad was a photographer. They probably made like about $1,000 a month between the two of them. And that was enough for them to raise a daughter in America, put her through college. She went to Smith College, is very successful now. And they only had to bring in like $1,000 a month and they just lived really cheaply. And that made a big impact on me when I was like 18, 19. I look at the whole like rat race that people put themselves through and I looked at them and I chose that. I'm like, yeah, I can keep my expenses down to like $1,000 a month and therefore I don't need to do anything I don't want to do. So even like musically, it's like I would just take the gigs I wanted to take and just, I was living a happy life as a musician because my expenses were only $1,000 a month, you know? And every time somebody says it's inevitable, they're like, yeah, well, you don't have kids. It's like, no, my role models had a kid and were able to do it at that. And it's just, you make that choice. Don't pretend that it's inevitable that you have to live it on, you know, you have to make $200,000 a year. That's a choice that you made. And if you're putting yourself in your own jail cell because of it, don't blame everybody else.
And that's like the biggest, that is the biggest line that business serves itself, right? It's like, oh, you know, there's two things that are happening right now. I can dream about doing the stuff we want to do versus this client is in front of me offering cold hard cash. And the direction is so obvious if you look at it from that perspective, right? But it's not, it very rarely leads to creating the company or the business or the concept that was the reason you got into this industry in the first place.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. I want to transition a little bit and talk about, it's a funny story because the way I came to know you, well, CD Baby I knew because I was actually in the music industry for a while too, but the way I came to know you is that you became this this guy on a mountain that other industries would go to seek advice. And I'm talking specifically about the book publishing industry. I know a lot of people wanted to get in touch with you and be like, okay, Derek, you took and helped independent people be very successful in an industry that's very crazy and then imploded and sort of killed itself. Like, please help us with this book industry, or please help us. So I'm curious, one is, was that an interesting place for you to be? Two, a little bit about sort of, did you have guidance for them? Like, what was your perspective on that? Because I know even to this day, you're sort of like, you're very much a wanted advisor.
I have a real problem with people who don't know how to say, I don't know. You know, when, like you, I go to a lot of conferences, and, you know, there's always a lot of panels, and there's a moderator who asks a whole bunch of panelists, like, what's the future of social media? And everybody starts flapping their damn mouth, but nobody actually knows. Like, why can't anybody just admit, I don't know? Like, we don't know the future. You don't know what the weather is going to be tomorrow, and you don't know what the future is going to hold. Like, why can't we just say, I don't know? So,
well, you haven't seen me speak recently, but I tell people, I have this big picture of crystal ball, and I say, for everyone who thinks I'm a futurist or have a vision for the future, I'm here to tell you, I hate the term futurist. I call myself a presentist. That's my new thing.
Right? Nice. Yes. Because that's all we can really talk about.
Right.
We can, like, you used that word trajectory earlier. I love that word. That, yes, we can say, here is the current trajectory in the present, but that doesn't mean that it won't all change tomorrow. Like, we don't know what, you know, whatever Google or Facebook or somebody's going to announce tomorrow, that we have no idea, or that something's going to change everything tomorrow. We don't know. And it's just, it's funny, you know, especially like pick up a copy of Wired magazine from 1994 or something, and there they are very confidently telling you exactly what the future will be, and it's so wrong. And anyway, okay,
it's always, isn't the answer always flying cars, though? That's my
of course, okay. That's coming in Q3. Yeah, people ask my advice, and honestly, my unless I've got it can go one of either two ways. Either I just say, I don't know, like, I'm sorry, I know nothing about books and the book industry, like, I'm sorry, I don't know what to tell you. And I just say that, like, because I don't care. I don't feel less about myself by not knowing the answer to the book industry. But you know what's funny, man? I don't know if you get this too, where okay, imagine, here's my metaphor for it. Somebody comes up to you and says, hey, Mitch, I've got this little kind of hen house, this coop here. Now, there are all these chickens in there, and they're just not laying any eggs. I mean, there are no eggs in there. I can't find any eggs at all. They've been in there for like months, and there are no eggs. And at first you think like, wow, no eggs. I wonder what that could be. Could it be some kind of like virus? Could it be something in the water? Could it be the time of the year? Maybe they're not getting enough sunlight. And then you think, well, you say to the person, like, I hate to ask you this, but have you looked under the chickens? And they say, oh, hold on a second. Oh my God, there's eggs under the chickens. I didn't even think about that. Thank you so much. Like, sometimes when people are asking you these consulting questions, it feels like that. It feels like almost insulting to say what you really want to say, like, have you tried asking your customers which new features they would like? I'm like, oh my God, asking my customers, I never thought about that. It's like, there's so many things that just, it seems so obvious, and I almost feel embarrassed to mention it, but people say it helps. So I guess maybe it's just, I ended up writing a whole essay about this that called obvious to you, amazing to others. If you're interested, it's kind of one of my favorite things I've written. It's on my site somewhere, that this feeling, like, our own thoughts feel so obvious to us, but yet other people's thoughts feel so amazing. Like, oh my God, how did they come up with that? And sometimes I think it's like, once I realize that, then I realize, oh, so other people look at me and think that my thoughts are amazing, whereas to me, they just seem totally obvious. So I guess it's all just like, because we, you know which books you've read and where your thoughts come from, but maybe they haven't read the same thing, and that's why the thoughts seem amazing. So, boy, that was a long, wandering answer to a short question.
No, Derek, that's why you're here. When you think back to CD Baby, was that part of it? It was so obvious too that, like, obviously independent artists will need a place to sell their stuff online. I mean, again, like, when you say it now, it's like really, it was Derek who did that?
I know. I just couldn't believe that nobody else was doing it, and yeah, it was completely obvious. Then even along the way, like, how to make it so simple. Like other people try to make things big and enterprisey and be, you know, and looking to raise billions. You know what I think is actually a flaw of a lot of people's business plans, especially these days when they've got role models like Facebook and Apple, that when people want to be the next Facebook or Apple, they're trying to think so damn big, like how to revolutionize everything or how to please every person on the planet. And because of that, they can't, like, they're completely overlooking just common sense on how you can, say, make a few thousand people much happier by doing something that a few thousand people need. So I think when I started CD Baby, like, to me, it's like, well, here's my musician friends. They need to sell their CD. And other people were looking at them going, broke musicians, you know, they don't have any money to pay me to do it. And they're not going to sell any albums anyway because they're broke musicians. I'm just going to set up a business plan that will sell Madonna and Miles Davis albums, but not these little broke musicians that have no fans. But they were overlooking that you could do something small and simple that would make thousands of people's lives better in a way that they'd be willing to pay for. You know what I mean? So it's like, by not being so ambitious and trying to reach billions, you can do something more useful to thousands.
I remember when Chris Anderson's book, The Long Tail, came out, I looked at the book, and we didn't know each other then, and I looked at the book and went, oh, CD Baby.
Exactly.
I was like, oh, he could have written this book in two words, CD Baby.
You know what was really redeeming? So I read through that book, and I'm just sitting there like going, yeah, duh. I mean, you're describing my business, my life. But he didn't mention CD Baby anywhere in the book.
I know.
Damn, dude. But you know what? Sure, like a week after the book came out, he was doing an interview on NPR, U.S. National Public Radio, and they said, can you give us some examples of The Long Tail? And he said, well, I think one of the best examples is CD Baby. And I was like, yes! And he just like sat there on NPR and described CD Baby and how it's kind of the perfect example of The Long Tail. So I think that was really kind of redeeming. He might not have just known about it yet when he wrote the book, but he did afterwards, so... And I, actually, Chris and I have become friends since then. We've like been at a few conferences together and met. And he's I really admire the way he thinks.
And he, you know, he's an interesting guy because similar to how we know each other, also through that sort of circuit, he's really open to like when he's working on new projects to get input. Like I know when he was doing Free, and I knew he was working on it, I kept sending him examples, and like he's really, it's amazing how he actually works in a highly collaborative way. And most people don't see him that way, but he really is. It's sort of interesting as a person that he's like that. I wanted to talk a little bit about the music industry because I think, you know, one, there's a perception of what the music industry is. And I'm wondering, when you reflect on it, do you see the role of CD Baby as being part of the destruction of what the old school music industry was? Or do you see it as part of the actual reinvention of it?
Oof, that's a heavy question. Part of the destruction. No, it felt like, you know what it felt like? It felt like CD Baby wasn't part of the music industry. Like I never felt I was like, honestly, like when I would pick up a Billboard magazine or something, I'd look through it and like, who, what? Like, what the hell are they? Like, I have no idea who these people are, what you're talking about, what kind of, like, I felt like I had nothing to do with the music industry. It felt like the music industry is the one that's talking about, you know, Lady Gaga audit stadium sales and Sony, you know, release scheduled down by 7% in Q3 or whatever, which just has nothing at all to do with the life of a musician who is writing some songs and wants some people to hear their songs and wants to play some clubs and make enough ticket sales to get to the next gig. Like, I felt like that was my world. It's kind of this world of musicians, which really have nothing to do with the music industry. Almost like as different as, say, like farming and McDonald's are. So, yeah, technically, you know, it's somebody who's a farmer and somebody who works at the headquarters of McDonald's. Like, somebody could kind of squint and say they're in the same industry, but it's really not. So I felt like, dealing with musicians, that's like working with farmers. sorry, bad metaphor maybe. But
let me ask you that question. Well, how would you answer that question now in reflection? Because it's a different question that way, isn't it?
Well, I still think that that everything I was doing had nothing to do with the rest of the music. Like, I think we weren't even a blip on like even after even near the time that I sold CD Baby, when you could say it was kind of at its peak, I met with one of the guys that was like one of the heads of Warner Music, and I said something about CD Baby, and they'd never ever heard of it. You know, so I honestly,
which
I
also
think it
speaks
kind of
to what happens in the music industry.
Well, you know what I mean? I really think I'd actually never made that comparison before, but I think the kind of McDonald's and the farming industry are kind of an apt comparison. That it's like at that big level, when you talk about the music industry, you are talking about this kind of like Lady Gaga, kind of 50 Cent, all this massive, giant millions of sales. And if something's happening way down there at the bottom with these like musicians selling a few hundred or a few thousand CDs, it just doesn't even show up on their radar at all. It just didn't. I'd say that CD Baby actually had no effect on the music industry.
And it's pretty dramatic to hear you say that, because, you know, when I think of a world of MySpace where I knew because of my friends from the industry, like you had A&R people who were like, oh, like I'm like a corporate 9-to-5er now. Why? Because I don't have to go to bars anymore. I can just sit on MySpace all day. And it's true. Like they did. And so it's funny that you say that, because while, yes, the music industry was about selling one CD to millions of people, and you were about selling thousands of CDs to thousands of people, you would think that they still would have a perspective of saying there might be gold in them there hills.
Yeah, you know what? Okay, here's a change that I was in the middle of, is that all this would have happened with or without CD Baby entirely. The whole kind of like, take like mp3.com, remember that? And MySpace and the CD Baby, and all of these together were the tools. The big, huge change that happened in the late 90s is that until the kind of mid-late 90s, a musician had to keep their focus on the record labels, because that was the only way to get out there. So the record labels did spend a lot more time like listening to demos and trying to hear, you know, pearls in the oysters, and trying to listen to gems and try to find hits. But once all these tools came out, like CD Baby and MP3.com and MySpace, all of a sudden it's like any musician can get their music out to the world. It did change the music industry, as far as like now they just had to sit back and see who was doing well. Because if you were not savvy enough to kind of test your market by putting up some songs on mp3.com and telling your fans to listen to them, and if nobody was listening to them, or you couldn't even get any fans, the record industry could look at that and go, all right, they're not going to make it. Like that's, we don't, the music industry stopped having to guess who was going to be a success. They just looked at who was already making a success of themselves, and then used their big giant industry to take it to the next level. You know what I mean? So it absolutely changed the music industry that way. But it wasn't like CD Baby changing it. It was just kind of part of a whole wave of like these internet tools that musicians could use to get their stuff out to the world, and that permanently changed everything.
Do you have any interest anymore in that world?
Well, I never did. Well, I mean, which world you're talking about?
Well, no, because listen, I knew from before the book that you really were a passionate musician and a singer, and I knew that you really, you know, even though CD Baby made you become more of a business person than maybe the musician, that you still had a passion for it, and you still actually cared about musicians. You wanted them to do well. You wanted their do you sell something like that and go, okay, like I know you're working on two other projects. Do you sort of think about like, well, what's next in that in this?
I finally think I distilled my interest down to one clear distinction, is I'm fascinated with music as a process, and I have no interest in music as a product. And it's a huge difference. So I'm fascinated with the creative process, the writing, the self-discovery, the creativity, the discipline, the communication, the anthropology, the sociology, the psychology, you know, all that kind of stuff around like making music and putting it out into the world, all of that completely fascinates me. The business of Lady Gaga ticket sales in stadiums or whatever, like, no, that's just no interest whatsoever. So, yeah, I'm still completely fascinated with like the I think of it also as a difference between the musician business and the music business. Like when I hear music business, I kind of think product.
Yeah.
When I hear the word musician, I think process. So, yeah, I'm still all of my new projects are completely focused on helping musicians.
I had a thought in my brain about, I wonder if Derek thinks about his next CD baby, but in hearing you speak, it sounds like a strange thing to ask.
Oh, my next, are you asking? Like, do I think of my next
CD baby? I don't
know.
I'm sort of putting a thought out there. I don't know. It seems...
No, I kind of feel like... I kind of feel like CD Baby was probably my biggest success, but I mean, it was much bigger than I ever wanted it to be. Like, I would have rather it was 10 times smaller. So I think, again, now if I do something that starts to grow that big, I might actually sell it earlier and just walk away. Because I really didn't enjoy those last few years. It was too big for my tastes. That's really what, actually, Seth, I don't know if you know from the book, but Seth Godin is the one that really kind of gave me that final little nudge to sell it, because
if you care, you'll sell it.
Yeah, like I was asking him, I'm like, here's my predicament, what do you do? And he was just saying, if you care, you need to sell, because you do not want the business to grow, and your clients, the musicians, they do want their careers to grow, so you're doing them a disservice by remaining at the helm. You really should sell it, because somebody else would like to make the business bigger and you don't. And that was a great point. I think I'd like to kind of take that lesson earlier from now on. So I'd love to start things, bring them, you know, from zero to stage five or something, whatever that may be, and then kind of sell it off earlier so people that are more ambitious than me and interested in managing more than inventing can run with it.
One of the biggest rookie mistakes you can make as someone asking somebody questions, especially in the music industry and the creative industry, is why did you call your album X? Why did you call your book Y? But I'm going to make that rookie mistake, because you called the book Anything You Want. And I found that interesting, because when I read it, it sounded like one of those books where it's like, oh, okay, this will teach me how to get anything I want. And it sort of is, but I think the book almost should have been called Anything I Want.
Honestly, man, this is why I feel kind of a little... when you asked at the beginning about like my, how I told you the book was really more of like Seth's doing than mine. So even when it comes to the title and the album, I mean the book cover and all that, they picked all of that. Like Seth and his kind of team of people from the Domino Project. So they picked all of that. I really just wrote the words, and okay, everything else, they did the rest. So they picked the title and the cover. I'm sorry.
No. I was really, because again, knowing you as a person, having great conversations with you, I thought, wow, that's like it was a very Tony Robbins inspirational type of title, which I think works. It just, the voice in the books sounded a little different.
You know, I kind of thought it was, I liked the title, The Music of Business.
Oh yeah, me too, actually.
Because you know, I thought it was like kind of a creative approach to music, to business. You know, The Music of Business, kind of a play on The Business of Music, which is a popular book in the music business. Yeah. There's a book, This Business of Music, that's really popular. So I like that. And Seth was just like, it's kind of cheesy. I was like, all right, whatever you pick. You know, it's like he's immersed in the world of like book titles and book covers and what works. I was like, okay, you just pick. I know nothing about this.
You've taken us on this really fascinating journey in the past couple minutes about where you're at. And I'm just curious, if you want to talk about it, what projects, like what is your day-to-day like? Like, do you work on, is it one specific thing? Is it five different things? Because as someone who's following you, I see your essays, you know, you're blogging. So I see that, but is there sort of one thing you're doing? Like, how do you sort of manage your life, your projects professionally?
For the most part, like my big vision, you know what, actually, this will be the first time I've ever kind of like said this publicly. Ta-da.
Let me get an audio for Six Pixels exclusive.
I really like I like the term parallel entrepreneur. Like we don't like serial entrepreneur, but to me, Richard Branson is kind of one person I can think of where the Virgin Group is his kind of holding company in the middle. And I think there's something like 180 companies under the Virgin Group. So it's like Virgin Rail, Virgin Cola, Virgin Brides, Virgin Money, Virgin airlines, you know, 6 different Virgin Airlines and Virgin Music and all this kind of stuff, Virgin Mobile. And so I like the fact that it's like he doesn't work at any of those companies. He's just the guy in the middle to kind of say, this seems worth doing. Let's do it. I'll fund it, christen it, kind of pick somebody really good to be in charge of it, and I'll just peek in every week or two on how it's going. Like, just give me a report on, and I'll give you my thoughts. But for the most part, he's just kind of the guy in the middle that gets to kind of wave the magic wand and say, let's do this, let's do that. So when I think of all these different things I want to do to help musicians, there are lots of projects. And if I were to do them in serial, it might take decades. And by the time I get around to them, they might be kind of moot. But if I were to find a way to do them in parallel, now that's exciting to me. So, but in order to do that, you'd have to kind of do it like I just described. Like, you'd have to, I'd have to just be the guy in the middle to say, okay, I will fund this and, I'll help guide it, mentor it, promote it a bit, but somebody else is going to have to run it, 'cause I can't run, you know, 6 companies in parallel, but I could, you know, somehow, like, so that's really what I'm working towards. So my day-to-day life is kind of, how can I, even if it's going to take me many years to do it, like, how can I build my skills to be able to make that happen? So whether it's improving my programming skills, learning more about some kind of core business concepts, or learning to get better at interviewing and hiring, or learning to get better at this, I've really spent the last 3 years, ever since I left CD Baby, completely focused on self-education and how to get better at this stuff, because that's my big vision that I'm working towards.
Awesome. So the book is called Anything You Want. It is, without a question, one of the best. For me, it was 60. For, I think, most people, it'll be 90 minutes. just read fast. They'll ever spend. Derek, I want to thank you so much, because, again, I do know how starved for time you can be. So thanks so much for taking part. Let people know where the easiest places they can connect to all your great content.
If you just go to siverz.org, siverz.org, the last thing I want to leave you with is that some of the coolest people I've met over the last couple of years are the people who find me through things like this. Like, honestly, like somebody who is a fan of the Six Pixels podcast is my kind of person that I'd love to meet. So some of the coolest people I've met are the ones that just drop me an email out of the blue, like, you know, hey, I read an article or such and such. So I highly recommend anybody who made it all the way through this, like, go to siverz.org and there's a contact me page there, and just send me an email and say hi, because I'd love to hear what other people are working on, and feel free to ask any questions or whatever. So yeah, I'm very happy to email with anyone.
Right, and it's, you know, it's through the marvels of Seth having this vision that allowed the more of the masses to be able to find, you know, thinkers like you and what you're doing. And I really, really was appreciative not only of us meeting, becoming friends, but the book really was one of those game changers for me this year. So thanks so much for writing it. I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks, Mitch. I appreciate it.
And I'll see you soon, I hope.
Yeah, we'll see you at one of these conferences. Awesome. We always do.
Thanks, Derek.
All right, take care. Tout ce petit geste. Qu'on a fait mille fois, des centaines de mots résonnent encore entre toi et moi. Voilà l'hiver qui s'abat sur moi. Je sens le vent qui me lacère, j'avance dans le froid. Tout ce petit geste, il tombe en place, mais ces nouvelles promesses te laissent des glaces. Sur nous les vagues se jettent. Nous emporte, nous emporte. Le chant des anges s'élève. Ils se moquent de nous s'entrelacent. Et nous étreignent encore. Les cours de l'amour résonnent. Ils se moquent de nous deux. Avant de s'éteindre, un rêve brisé. Et que le temps vienne nous renverser. Entends le serment qu'ils ont prononcé. Tant de mots qui resteront gravés. Sur nous les vagues se jettent. Nous emportent, nous emportent. Le chant des anges s'élève. Ils se moquent de nous s'entrelacent. Et nous étreignent encore. Les cons de l'amour résonnent. Ils se moquent de nous deux.
petits gestes qu'on a fait mille fois. Des centaines de mots résonnent encore entre toi et moi. Tout ce petit geste, il tombe en place. Mais ces nouvelles promesses te laissent de glace. Sur nous les vagues se jettent, nous emportent, nous emportent. Le chant des anges s'élève, ils se moquent de nous entrelacent et nous étreignent encore.